You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
I'm imitating the jingles on the station because they're just not happening. Sipho Mandlam-Gwanazi is with us this evening, senior economist at FNB. Average mortgage, middle class mortgage, Sipho Mandlam, is about, 2 million rand. And generally, people will take out a 20-year mortgage. How much did it cost to service a mortgage before interest rates started going up in South Africa?
Bruce, good evening. Good evening to your listeners. We have seen average instalment doubling since we started hiking interest rates in November 2021. On a 2 million bond, estimated somewhere around, at the moment, somewhere around 18,000-19,000. And this is from somewhere around 11,000 at the time when interest rates were at their lowest. So we have seen that squeeze coming through in the market, especially for the low end of the market, where your average LTVs are actually higher. So there's a higher reliance on credit for those homeowners, as opposed to your higher income earners who have a slightly lower LTV. So that is really coming through mainly in the lower end of the market.
LTV, loan to value, to be clear on that. When you're talking about when rates were at their lowest, this is when the Reserve Bank cut interest rates to the bare bones, to their lowest levels in 40 years. That was during COVID, right? Then to service a 2 million rand bond would cost you 11,000 rand a month. I mean, it was a brilliant opportunity for people to pay down their bonds. Those that didn't pay down their bonds are paying almost twice as much now, you say.
Yes. No, in fact, what we saw at the time, Bruce, was that there were a lot of, especially first-time buyers, mainly your millennials, who brought forward their buying decisions at the time to take advantage of these low interest rates. And that was the first wave of buying when interest rates were low. And then when that subsided, we then saw a second wave of buying. And this was now when, your repeat buyers were moving away from the cities, from the big cities towards your smaller coastal towns in the main. And those buyers tend to have stronger balance sheet. They tend to have access to equity and better access to credit markets. So really what we saw was buyers, these two different groups of buyers taking advantage of low interest rates rather than paying off their mortgages at the time.
Yeah, I mean, when people were then getting themselves in over their heads, I suspect, because we'd had a period of time where interest rates had not gone up for an awfully long period of time, and there was a view that interest rates would stay low forever. Nobody anticipated, or very few people anticipated, the interest rate shock that would come in 2021, 2023, that would drive the cost of money from 7.25% before COVID to currently 11% after tomorrow's interest rate increase. How much distress has that caused in the mortgage markets? What is your data telling you, Sipho Mandlam?
Yeah. So, Bruce, we are concerned about the level of distressed selling at the moment. But at this rate, it is something. It's not something we've never seen before. For instance, our quarterly estate agent survey estimates that about 17% of all sales that take place at the moment are due to financial pressure. So those owners would then look for a cheaper property. At around 17%, it's somewhere around the long-term average. So nothing we've never seen before. It has come down slightly from around 20% in the fourth quarter of 2022. And mainly, I have a very strong suspicion that this pertains mainly to the first wave of buying that I outlined, those ones that your first-time buyers that took advantage of that low interest rate at the time. And that squeeze now is coming through with this interest rate almost doubling from those levels. We are also starting to be concerned about the level of delinquencies, but the NCR data will give us a bit more clues around where those levels are at the moment. But for all indications at this stage suggest that this pressure is mainly in the lower end of the market.
Sibamandla Mgwanazi, thank you, the senior economist at FNB. It was, remember, we saw that boom in property prices under 3.5 million. There was a huge celebration. People were getting into the property market and it was looking great. But if you were paying the maximum that you could at that particular point when interest rates were sitting at record lows, the moment rates started going up, you either had to find extra money or found yourself falling short on your bond repayments. And that seems to be what is playing out right now. If you are one of those people who won't mind telling us your story, somebody who went and bought a property when things looked rosy, robust and rambunctious, I would love to hear from you this evening on 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Or if you don't want to face a couple of questions, I would love to get a WhatsApp from you, a voice note on 072-702-1702. Listening to that, Director and Chief Economist at Econometrics, Dr. Azhar Jameen, I think it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that we get another 25 basis points tomorrow. Azhar, any chance of any more than that?
I don't think we'll get more than that. I don't think we'll get less than that. You're absolutely right. I think the die was set last week when our inflation figures came out slightly higher than the previous month's figures. And that was a complete contradiction to what consensus forecasts were, for which were looking for a fourth consecutive decline in inflation. And we know what the reasons are. Food prices are sticky, continuing to rise faster than we anticipated, partly because of load shedding. And the rand has been rather weak. And as a consequence, we saw that even excluding food and fuel, inflation rose quite sharply from 4.9 to 5.2%. And the Reserve Bank has often told us that, it looks at the core inflation rate to tell it what to give it an idea of whether we are seeing knock-on effects through the rest of the economy. And then no sooner had we had that news than we got the news from the United States, through the Federal Reserve Board, the Bank of England, the Swiss National Bank and the Norwegian National Bank all raised their interest rates by 0.25%. Now, the fact that they raised by 0.25% and not more than that is the reason why I don't think our bank will go higher and go for a 0.5% hike either. So I think it's a done deal that we'll get a 25 basis point increase tomorrow.
Are we seeing central banks taking a bit of a gamble when it comes to inflation, betting that inflation will trend down lower later on in the year? They don't want to upset markets too much. They don't want to sort of pull the tiger of the banks crisis that we've seen emanate out of the United States and sort of threaten to bubble over into Europe. They don't want to see sort of pull that tiger's tail. So raise interest rates, show to be consistent, but do it cautiously. They seem to be apprehensive about perhaps the 50 basis point hike, which may be needed to nail inflation more quickly.
You're right, but they've got another, there's another risk on their horizon at the moment, and that is the very steepness of the increase in interest rates has created all sorts of financial pressures for the banking sectors around the world. Because banks normally borrow money short-term and lend it out long-term, like your mortgages. And what's been happening in recent times is the steepness of the increase in short-term interest rates has been well in excess of the increase in long-term interest rates. So they're now losing a lot of money in borrowing short-term and lending out long-term. And we saw the SBV bank coming under stress as a consequence of that. And the fear is that other banks will also similarly come under stress, and that is why they're reluctant to increase interest rates as steeply as we might have expected them to do about a month ago before we got all the news about the financial stress. In fact, there is the other risk that they're taking now, and that is that by raising interest rates, even by 25 basis points, they may be exacerbating the possibility of a new banking crisis and a plunge into global recession. So it's a tricky balancing act that they are playing. And unfortunately, our Reserve Bank is caught in the middle of that and will have to follow what the other banks are doing similarly.
Dr. Azhar Jameen, if you could hold just a moment, because Sean in Greenstone has a point to make, and I may need your backup on this one. Hello, Sean.
Good evening, Bruce, and to Azhar there.
Great show as always. Just an issue I wanted to pick up on. Yeah, interest rates are very important, but I think the biggest reason why people are struggling at the moment is they are not getting inflation rate-based increases at work. Most of the people I'm speaking to are getting 3-4% increases if they're lucky, whereas interest or inflation is close to 7%, even probably a bit higher if you speak to some people. At the moment, there's that whole competition commission going on at the moment to see what is actually, you know, the increase in costs on goods, household goods at the moment. In America, they've kind of found out about 52% of the inflation that they were facing was just coming down to corporate profits. So we have a situation where corporates are making huge profits, paying generally their CEOs massive amounts of money in their top tier, and then the general workers aren't getting enough to actually buy things anymore, essentially.
And also, I suppose I buy the fact that we're seeing, you know, below inflation salary increases. Unless you're a public servant, of course, then you're getting 7.5%. But here's the other problem, Sean, is that lots of people are losing their jobs, so they don't have those salaries to rely on. And the other part is that the part of the inflation basket that is rising more quickly than everything else is the stuff that you really, really need, the stuff that sucks money out of your bank account. So that comes in administered prices. It's primarily councils and government costs, so electricity, fuel, energy costs generally. But I think your point is well made, Sean. Thank you. And thank you for adding luster to the cluster this evening. I mean, Sean's point is well made there, Azar, in terms of low wage increases to try and keep a lid on corporate inflation because they're trying to keep going in a dysfunctional environment. But at the same time, the administered costs, the cost of living in South Africa, much higher than the average inflation rate suggests. And that's also hurting households.
And that's actually one of the key factors that the Reserve Bank keeps citing as to why they feel that they feel obliged to keep raising interest rates the way they're doing. Now with a prospective 18.5% increase in electricity tariffs and with the public servants getting 7.5%, the Reserve Bank has all the more reason to be fearful of an increase in overall inflation. And unfortunately, the poor private sector has to suck the hind tit, as the saying goes. Yeah.
Or teat. We can say teat. That's okay too. But as I mean, households are in an invidious position. We've seen consumer confidence surveys coming out showing that South Africans' consumer confidence is down the drain. All of the big global surveys are suggesting that if we get positive economic growth this year, it's going to be something of a miracle. 0.1, 0.2, 0.3%. That was at the worst levels of load shedding. We are in an environment that is very, very brittle for ordinary people right now.
There's no question that people are feeling the pinch. The one saving grace that, well, if you could call it that, that we've been seeing for individuals in recent times is there has been a pickup in household borrowing in a manner that we haven't seen for almost a decade. And the ratio of borrowing to disposable income is at a relatively modest level because we haven't had a borrowing boom for a decade now. So there is a capacity for people to carry on borrowing. And in that sense, 11% prime rate is not the highest that we've seen by any means over the last few decades. It's not that huge. In fact, just prior to COVID-19, we had 10.5% prime rate. So, thank heaven for small mercies, but that is preventing a total collapse in consumer spending at the moment.
You and I bear the scars of interest rate cycles past, but for many people, they've never considered the possibility of higher inflation and higher interest rates, because in 2015, people thought inflation was something that they were going to read about in history books. They didn't think it would exist again. They didn't think that interest rates could go up again, even to the relatively modest levels historically of 11% by South African standards. People were buying houses at 7% interest rates because that's what the Reserve Bank did to stop the system falling over during COVID. And they thought, well, that's normal. We'll do that because now it's affordable. Suddenly, it's no longer affordable.
There's no question. The only bit of good news that I think one can give at the moment is that I don't think we're going to get many more such increases in interest rates in the foreseeable future. So, 10-11% might just turn out to be the peak for the moment.
Provided, of course, we can keep the lights on, provided we can do a couple of basics and get that right, then the year will bumble along as we are used to. Dr. Azar Jameen, thank you. Director and Chief Economist. listed econometrics and also interesting stats from Sipho Mandla this evening as well at FNB, just giving us a perspective. I was doing some sums earlier. I remember 2021, so that's a more realistic comparison than going to the very low base that was set during COVID. It would have cost you at an interest rate of 7.25%, because that's where interest rates were before this current rate hiking cycle started. It would have cost you 15,700 rand every month to service a bond of 2 million rand, a 20-year bond of 2 million rand. After tomorrow's increase, it'll cost you around 20,400 rand to service that same bond. It's an increase of a good 25%. No wonder households are struggling, because during that time, of course, petrol prices have rocketed up. Your property has been revalued. If you bought a property, your local council has revalued your property and has upped your rates and taxes. The cost of electricity has gone up. The cost of food has gone up substantially as well. So, yes, households certainly feeling a lot of strain. But to Azarjameen's point, not the level of strain that we've seen in previous crazy cycles. This is a much calmer down cycle than we've seen in many years gone by.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
And to Chris Stewart, our market commentator this evening. I don't know. I want to get a cloth and put it on my forehead and have a nice lie down. We've had 3 days of gains in a row, Chris Stewart. I'm beginning to feel like things are headed back to a happy place.
Yeah, Bruce, I don't know. From your lips to God's ears, I guess I would say with that one. I don't particularly feel like reliving a week like last week again in a hurry. So if we can have some semblance of normality and calm returning to financial markets, and if the banks can keep the show on the road, particularly on a global basis, I'd be very grateful for that, yeah.
Absolutely. When you look at trading update out of Barlow World today, it's a 5-month trading update. And despite a meltdown in Russia, as you would expect there to be, courtesy of sanctions and the fact that Barlow World is not participating in sanctions, South Africa remaining so-called neutral in the war against Ukraine, Barlow World's trading update looking quite good.
Yeah, particularly, as you indicate, if you adjust for the fact that the revenue in their Russian business has fallen off a cliff, and I think outside of that, they've done all the right things they can in the Russian business to try and preserve margin, change business mix to higher margin business and cut costs out of that business. So they're doing whatever they can, but you know they can't do a whole hell of a lot about what's happened to the revenue line in Russia. If you isolate for that, the group revenue of 15% growth, which itself is not a bad number, is considerably stronger. And that is really being driven by the Equipment SA business, which makes up about just over 60% of group business, putting in a very, very strong performance, growing their revenue 42%, with 64% growth in revenue due to machinery sales, 30% due to parts. So there's a little bit of negative mix coming through in the SA business. They earn a lower margin on selling you a Caterpillar truck than they do on selling you the parts for that particular Caterpillar vehicle. But mining sector activity ticking up in South Africa, the replacement cycle, I guess, coming back on stream post-COVID has driven a very, very strong performance out of the South African business. Operating margin, as I said, slightly down on mix, but the order book remaining pretty healthy, up 20% odd on the prior period. So, you know, South Africa equipment going well, Russia doing all the right things they can, the Mongolian business doing much better with the Chinese borders now opening up. That's provided a positive tailwind to their other Eurasian equipment business. And then the ingrain business domestically really suffering from the strain on being experienced by all consumer industries in South Africa. Margin pressure coming through that business, flat domestic revenue, but offset to a large degree by the fact that soft commodity prices have been fairly buoyant. Export volumes have been quite good. And what I guess is the most refreshing is we're talking about Barlow World now without talking about the balance sheet first time around. There was a time for a long time where, you know, every time we talked about Barlow World, we were talking about the balance sheet, what they were doing to repair the balance sheet, asset disposals, of which the last one being their leasing and car rental business, which has now been done. The Zida, as opposed to Zieder, business has been disposed of. That's got their net debt to EBITDA stable at about 1x, and interest cover looking very healthy. So no balance sheet concerns at Barlow World, which is a good thing.
I'm not going to waste your time discussing the inevitable 25 basis point rate hike tomorrow, but what we can touch on is a big sale by Chris Becker, the man who, when he was chief executive, took various bets in places like China on technology companies. One of those hit a most astonishing seam of good fortune, and that was Tencent. And of course, Tencent has been the mainstay of Naspers now for over 20 years. And shareholders have benefited hugely. Chris Becker, in the interim period between CEO and chairman at one stage, sold lots of shares, so didn't have to declare that publicly. Now that he is chairman, though, he is having to declare share sales, and he's sold 3.5 billion rands worth of Prosus shares. The Becker kids are going to have a good Christmas, it would seem.
That could have been the mystery question for the night, and what is the significance of 25? And that's that we're getting 25 basis points tomorrow, and Chris Becker sold 25% of his Prosus stake. But yeah, as you point out, he still retains 75%. So if you like, he's still got another, 10.5 billion rands worth, plus all of his Naspers shares. And, you know, he's sold a portion over the last 3 or 4 days. The announcement coming out this evening that those shares have been sold. And ostensibly, it sounds as like the hotels at Babylon Sturin in the UK and Italy need a coat of paint, and that they've got to go out and do some work on the hotels and needed some liquidity in order to do so. So nothing too sinister, I think, if you look at the fact that the residual exposure is still significant, and I guess taking advantage perhaps of some sort of rebound and buoyancy in the Prosus share price. And I think what happened in Alibaba at Alibaba overnight and the jump that it saw on the Hong Kong exchange overnight on the news that they will probably be splitting that business into a variety of its component entities, providing a further tailwind to global tech stocks today.
I can't think of anybody else in South African history other than perhaps Cecil John Rhodes and early landlords, perhaps, who have made such a fortune out of listing businesses on the JSE, buying assets, Chris Becker famously taking no salary for a decade or more as chief executive of Naspers, as he acquired businesses and he realized that he'd got himself a winner with Tencent. And got paid in shares instead. And he has harvested the most astonishing payday time and time again out of the willingness to back his instincts on China at a time where others would have been more wary to do so. He's done incredibly well, Chris.
Yeah, indeed he has. And, you know, you talked about a seam of luck in terms of Tencent, and perhaps, of course, himself will admit that there was a seam of luck in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's a lot of... There's a lot of acumen, a lot of self-belief, a lot of backing yourself, and all credit to him. I think he's made himself a lot of money, and he probably deserves it, Bruce.
There we go. Chris Stewart, portfolio manager at 91 this evening. Chris Becker's payday, 3.5 billion rand for a third of his stake in Prosus. There's a lot more money left on the table there. And yeah, the story of Chris Becker. I'm going to be at the Franschhoek Literary Festival reviewing one of the books I'm reviewing. They're making me work this year at the Franschhoek Literary Festival. I'm looking forward to it. But one of the books is the Chris Becker book on billions. And it will be interesting to dissect the strategy, the thinking, the thought process of Chris Becker in the creation of an astonishing personal fortune via a listed company. Sheer genius, really is.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB, committed to driving Africa's energy transformation and offering expertise in advising international businesses in making investments on the continent. Absa is a registered FSP.
ShopRite's finally doing what many other retailers domestically and around the world are doing, and that's selling clothes. We'll pick up on that in just a moment. On your next Money Show, we'll look at the Reserve Bank's Monetary Policy Committee decision on interest rates. We'll figure out just how you can better cope with the rising cost of living as a result of more and more fees coming your way. Warren Ingram, the personal financial advisor, executive director at Galileo Capital. Whether or not a strategy of spend when you're young and saving when you're older can work for you. Plus Pavlo Fotidis, tips for your small business. All next time on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter @BruceBusiness.
Pick n Pay is making a killing out of clothing. Its margins are probably the best in its business in the clothing division. It's got the standalone Pick n Pay clothing stores and big retailers around the world. So traditional grocers have been making substantial clothing retail businesses come to life. News today that ShopRite is launching its own standalone clothing store called Unique. So unique, they've taken the U and the E off the brand name, UNIQ. Makwe Masilela is the Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers. And this is sort of ShopRite coming quite late to the party, Makwe.
Definitely it is, you know, even though they did on us, you know, almost 2-3 months back, and good evening to you. But if, you know what, it's better than nothing. And absolutely, if you have an opportunity to diversify your revenue stream, why not, Bruce?
No, completely. And ShopRite, has ShopRite dabbled in clothing before, or is this a brand new line? I'm trying to think of ShopRite stores I've been to, and I can't visualize clothing anywhere. They're pots and pans and fancy cutlery and crockery and medicines, and they've got pharmacies. They've got absolutely everything else, but not clothing as best as I can recall anywhere.
And not at all. And as you said, you know, into the likes of Pick n Pay, making a killing out of that, the likes of Macro, making a killing out of that. You know, there used to be a joke that when you're not wearing good things, they will say your wife, when is buying grocery, then they pick up some T-shirt and shirt for you. So now it's more of a reality because people are looking for value for money. We start to appreciate all these things. Look at the other guys, you know, even though they're not involved in grocery. People, when it's the price of this world, the H&M, you know, Cotton On. So Checkers, having proven themselves, number one, not just with the lower LSM, but they're also now trying to give the likes of Woolworths a run for their money when it comes to the higher LSM. It's worth their while to try this one as well to see how well can they do, you know. And anyway, they'll get to a point where food is something else. High inflation when it comes to food, we've just seen with the inflation numbers that have been raised. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to clothing, it seems as if inflation there is still decent enough, and hence the likes of Pick n Pay can still be able to make good margins out of that. So they've got the room to play around the prices.
Yeah, ShopRite's first store will open at the Canal Walk Shopping Centre in Cape Town tomorrow, and then 8 other shops in the next month or so. And no doubt there'll be an aggressive rollout after that. They would have done their sums, they would have done their maths, they would have decided where to locate their first stores. But this is a global trend. I mean, we've seen so many other globals. George was the brand. At Macro. Macro is owned by, of course, by the Americans, by Walmart. Walmart also owns Asda in the United Kingdom. And I've seen George clothing, extensive lines of George clothing. And a lot of the stuff is really good quality. It may be inexpensive, but it's really good quality stuff. And in that search for value, consumers around the world have more and more been trending towards the supermarket shop, even for clothing.
I think also the lack of Mark and Spencer, if I'm not mistaken, and I think what will be critical with the likes of ShopRite, if they can also going forward copy what is the Foschini Group is doing, trying to source most of those clothing locally. So yeah, it's not just going to be a benefit for them. Also, the whole value chain stream, we might have to benefit out of that. And remember, textile, we used to be very big in textile in South Africa. It's just a question of rekindling that industry. So all I'm saying is, yes, well and good. We hope they manage to open more, but also look into this whole value chain and continue to try to follow the footsteps of the Foschini Group. That will be excellent for the country.
Who is going to suffer most as a result of this? I mean, I assume Pep is going to be quivering in its boots tonight. Ackermans is going to be quivering in its boots tonight. Mr. Price, probably. H&M even going to be quivering, because ShopRite doesn't go to war unarmed. It's going to be, you know, when it chooses to do something, it chooses to do it seriously, and they will do it at scale.
Definitely, and they've got a very decent balance sheet. They are able to roll out as many as they can. They are able to cut prices if need be. And you are right, you know, the likes of Ackermans, Repair, but definitely they will feel the pain, the likes of the Jet of this world. But anyway, we as consumers, we should be happy because competition is healthy, and probably that will continue to help to get the prices to go low, and maybe we might get into have lots of markdowns. But hey, I think the space is just too big to be able to allow another player into this whole thing.
Yeah, look, I think it's going to be fascinating, Makwe. Thank you, Makwe Masilela, the Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers. Yeah, the company, the brand is going to be Unique, UNIQ, launching at Canal Walk in Cape Town tomorrow, and then 8 stores in the next month. So they're going to be deadly serious about this. ShopRite is going to rattle the South African clothing sector, and profit margins in clothing are very good because anybody who imports clothing knows that the duties on clothing imports are very, very high. That's why you pay eye-watering prices for big brands. And it's why the big South African retailers, the Foschini Groups, the Edgars, they of the world, have are sourcing most of what they sell now domestically because it's so much cheaper and therefore good for jobs, good for the economy. Ultimately, that's the sort of thing that we need to see more, but not so good this evening. If you're the bosses of Pick and Pay Clothing, they'll be looking at this going, ooh, they're coming for us. Mr. Price, Ackermans, Pep. I don't know who else will suffer. Will he suffer? I'm not so sure. But H&M and others, no doubt Zara, maybe getting a little bit concerned. But yes, we'll keep a very, very close eye on ShopRite's venture into clothing.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Look, anybody doing anything to tackle the jobs crisis is doing some very, very good work indeed. I'm curious to see as to how a new Standard Bank initiative is going to impact, if at all, job creation. Craig Polkinghorne is the head of commercial clients at Standard Bank. You're offering an interest rate reduction on loans, some quite substantial loans, loans of a certain size, 30 million rand loans or more. If that money, if the difference in interest rate then goes to actually hiring an individual. Craig, explain how this works.
Bruce, hello, good evening, and thanks for having me on the show. In our commercial banking business, we bank some of the larger entrepreneurs in the country. They are heavily invested in the communities and the economies in which they operate, all of which are in South Africa, and often in the less populated parts of the country and outside of the big metros. And so this is really aimed at them. They have, in our discussions with them, indicated an interest to support their own communities and do things that improve the health of those communities, which includes employment. And so I asked some of our young members in our business what we might do, and they came back with very enthusiastically, so this obviously resonated with our own team, but they came back with the idea that if we gave a reduction on the interest rate in order to indicate that the bank was prepared to, in effect, pay for employment to go up, could we ask people to join us in that initiative and employ some more people? So very simplistically, it's a loan with interest rate reduction, covenanted against higher employment.
Okay, so but if I take a 30 million rand loan from you to grow my business, you will give me a 0.25% interest rate reduction. That equates, that amount on 30 million rand a month, 30 million rand equates to the equivalent of a minimum wage job per month, right? Is that roughly the ballpark of what you're talking about here?
That's correct. So that's the maths of it. And you need that maths because we're bankers from the starting point. You know, the starting point. What we would hope is that the philosophy is actually more important than the maths.
Correct.
And we would hope that people would make unemployment and employment a topic about which people are happy to engage and talk. And if you were going to take 30 million rand as a loan and employ 10 people and you were prepared to covenant that, then that's fantastic. And then 10 people are going to get a job.
Does it really make that much of a difference? I mean, if I'm going to borrow 30 million rand to grow my business, I'm going to need extra people anyway. Does you giving me a small discount on an interest rate incentivize me to create additional jobs? Does it have any, what does the maths say on the likely incentive return on this initiative?
So, Bruce, my response would be you don't know if you don't try.
Sure.
The entrepreneurs that we have engaged on this topic are very willing to support us and try and make a difference. And the other thing that we want to do is we want to be transparent on this and report on it so that every month or every quarter, we can say, you know, this month we have employed or caused together with the entrepreneurs X amount of people to find a job. And I think hopefully, as I said, this becomes a talking point rather than a loan incentivization or an interest rate incentivization kind of product. And it's to try and link the financial sector and the real economy, because our clients operate in the real economy. You know, they do stuff and they make stuff, and try and bring all of that together as a private sector initiative to make a difference.
Craig, I look forward to seeing how it works and what sort of return on investment you get on it. Craig Polkinghorne, Head of Commercial Clients at Standard Bank. And it's a fairly simple idea. They will have an interest rate. They will give a 25 basis points, so a 0.25% discount on that interest rate if you borrow at least 30 million rand and create a job out of it as well. You've also got to employ an additional person too. So, I mean, again, for every 30 million rand that Standard Bank lends out for a period of time, two more jobs will be created. And 30 million rand in today's money isn't a vast amount of money for many businesses. Could they create 100 jobs a month? Could they create more than that? I don't know. They don't know. They're trying it. It's good for them. Trying it out, because, geez, so for every job you create, you just give one person hope. And there is the butterfly effect that goes through a household, that goes through a community, as more and more people get opportunities to have dignified employment. Good stuff. Thank you, Craig Polkinghorne at Standard Bank.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Welcome to The Money Show. It's brought to you by Absa CIB. Absa CIB is proud to be have provided advisory services and financing for Infinity Power's acquisition of Lekela Power, Africa's largest renewables-focused independent power producer. Absa is a registered FSP. We'll do Business Unusual in just a moment. We'll have Wendy Knoll, our consumer ninja, for you at about 20 past 7. And then at 7:30, our shapeshifter is the creator of insurance companies like no one else I know. I don't know Christelle Coleman. I've spoken to her once or twice, but she seems to be prolific in the world of creating insurance businesses. I wonder why, and I wonder how, and I wonder to what end, and how long she stays invested. All of those questions. If you know Christelle and you give me some insight, do share this evening on our WhatsApp number. Be curious. 072-702-1702. Drop us a note and let me know. What it is, has she got the Midas touch when it comes to creating insurance businesses? I came across a lovely poem earlier today. It's slightly depressing, but at the same time, quite liberating in terms of, I think, our state of mind right now. And if I can find it in just a moment, it's called Good Bones. It's by a writer called Maggie Smith. I'm sure there are lots of Maggie Smiths in the world. But before we get to Business Unusual, I'm feeling philosophical. Philosophical this evening. Life is short, though I keep this from my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I'll keep from my children. The world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate, although I keep this from my children. For every bird, there's a stone thrown at a bird. For every loved child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short, and the world is at least half terrible, and for every kind stranger, there's one that would break you, though I keep this from my children. I'm trying to sell them the world. Any decent realtor, real estate agent, walking you through a real dump, chirps on about good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You could make this place beautiful. Certainly what estate agents will tell you every time they take you through a less than glorious property. But yeah, do you keep secrets from your kids? Do you keep secrets? Do you try and protect them from the world? Or do you let them know in all of its gory detail what it is like? I wonder how you deal with it. It's a nice little poem by a writer called Maggie Smith. A little, what is it called? It's a deviation on The Money Show this evening.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual.
Business Unusual brought to you by Isuzu EasyGo. Why own a pre-built truck when you can rent it? Thanks to creative solutions from Isuzu Finance. T's and C's apply. Zanele Njapa is the unlearning expert, the facilitator. Psychological safety. Oh my goodness me, Zanele. What are you talking about? Psychological safety at work. What is this concept?
Thank you so much, Bruce. It's lovely to be having a conversation with you again. So I think one of the best ways to understand psychological safety, at least on my end, I like to think of it as freedom of expression, but at work, in the work context. So this is when people feel like they can express their ideas, they can express their concerns, they can express their perspectives and views without this fear of ridicule or retaliation or possibly any kind of negative consequence in a kind of safe space.
I remember working for a company once, a long time ago, and I recall very clearly the staff meeting at which I heard the then CEO suggest something similar. And they said, you know what, if you got a problem, come and tell us. Come and tell us exactly how you feel. And I recall a colleague going to tell the CEO exactly what they felt. That colleague returned from the CEO's office, packed their stuff in a bag, and we never saw them again. There is psychological safety, there's a pretense of psychological safety, and there's also not understanding boundaries at work. When we talk about psychological safety at work, what exactly are we talking about?
So I love that example, because that's what creates that sense of fear. It's because it's one thing to say that we're a family, and this is one that a lot of people tend to find cheesy nowadays. We're a family. Yeah. but also you can say what you feel, share your perspective. And one of the reasons why organizations will often position us is because it's actually really good for innovation and creativity, which it actually is. But then in practice, what we see is something completely different. And that, I think, for me, always points to the value of culture, but also how culture is not what we puts on the wall or what's on the plaque that's been gathering dust. It's what's in practice. And that's why I feel like the conversation around psychological safety is something to tap into, to understand whether or not people feel like it's there. It's one thing to say that that's what's going on, but it is another thing to feel like maybe that's not actually how we practice. Because on the other side of me speaking up is a negative consequence, is me losing my job, is me getting a salary decrease, is all sorts of other consequences that then have me rather not being the person who speaks up.
But there's got to be a sense of common sense about this thing as well. I mean, in the same way as our Constitution, for example, guarantees the freedom of speech, but it doesn't mean that you can be a bile-spreading, spewing, racist, bigoted, homophobic, nasty piece of work simply because the Constitution says that you have freedom of speech. There's a level of common sense and decency and responsibilities that come with it. So you can have psychological safety, but if you go into the CEO's office and say, you know what, thank you for creating the space of psychological safety. I think you're a lunatic. I think you're spending too much money. I think you're wasting. I think the management team that you've hired are a bunch of idiots. If you're going to abuse that psychological safety, this place where you are allowed to express an opinion, you've got to do it within the bounds of common decency, right?
Absolutely. So this is why it's important to consider maybe two key factors here. And to what you were saying, Bruce, one of those are the policies of the organization, whether it's an HR-leaning policy, but whatever the organization says is the proper channel. That's another story altogether. But looking at the policies is one way. And then the other direction is the channels that we have in order to do that. So for example, having an opportunity as a team for us to say, okay, at 3 p.m. on a Wednesday morning, we have forums that we have every single week that are a space for us to do that. Then people are able to compartmentalize, and leaders, if they are the individuals that will be on the firing line in that instance, can position the space, but also prepare themselves, prepare whatever else is needed around the space so that it's almost like think of it as a kind of a green room or bulletproofed room where whatever we say in this room stays in here, but also the consequences around it is minimized in some kind of way, but also according to the policies that we have around how we speak to each other, how we approach each other, what's allowed and what isn't.
I wonder how many managers have got the true strength of character and the will to open themselves up to weekly, regular unbridled criticism. I look around many, many companies that I know and people who work within companies. Yes, there's constructive criticism. There is, I think we can do this better. I can think we can make an improvement here. Would you like to consider the following things? But unleashing, and this term of psychological safety strikes me as quite a dangerous concept in terms of the way in which it's interpreted by people who want to use the opportunity to vent. People who are, I don't know, frustrated, don't like the place, but couldn't be bothered to leave. Do you get where I'm going with this?
I absolutely get where you're going. And this is why I feel like it's important right from the outset to manage the conversation. So setting expectations out from right at the beginning. And what this might mean is making it very clear that what we intend to achieve at the end of the day is the entire growth of yourselves as the team, but also for the entire organization. Then everyone is not looking at our Wednesday morning session, for example, as an opportunity for us to just throw rocks at everyone, but an opportunity for us to say, how would I respond or how would I act and make a decision if this was my business? Where do I feel we can grow? Then the energy, and I hope you can feel the energy and the difference between those two things, then it means absolutely, we speak respectfully to each other. We give each other space to express what we feel needs to be expressed. But when it is a consistent process, Bruce, what starts to happen is that people don't bottle things up and they don't get an opportunity like we get the festering of individuals in an organization who will go, I'm not happy. So they'll turn over, swing their chair over to the person next to them and go, hey, aren't you also not happy? And then it grows because we don't have these little cubicles for us to go, okay, guys, so what's actually going on? Do you feel like you can express some of those opinions that you have? And if so, what are they?
You've also then got to have a huge amount of integrity in that process as well and be open as a management team to honestly tackle those things which can be tackled, to respond to the things that perhaps are harder to change, and to be absolutely honest about that process as well, saying, you know, I also don't like the fact that, well, whatever happens, the sugar disappears on a Saturday night or whatever the case is. We're working and trying to solve it. We don't know if we can, but we'll do our very best. And show real willingness to act on the input from people, because there's nothing more soul-destroying than asking people for input and then simply ignoring them, because that is a whitewash at best.
Absolutely. There is an intense halo effect that we're seeing around psychological safety, where teams are of the opinion that our leaders don't feel the stretch the way that we do. They don't feel the pinch the way that we do. So one thing that, or two key things that I think are very helpful or will give a really great place to start, and I found these work really, really well, is reducing the sense of uncertainty that is growing around where we are, where we're going, and how we feel. But then the second one is helping people feel seen. So maybe going back to reducing uncertainty, what you said was so beautiful, Bruce. It just comes down to that transparency. Say what you know and what you feel is safe so that the team has that sense of, we understand what you understand at the level you feel we can comprehend for now. Because you want to almost close and reduce those gaps, because it's that uncertainty that gets people riled up. And then that last one is helping people feel seen. Sometimes people just want to be validated. I think a lot of the time we overlook this one and we go, I don't have time to coach babies. But I think that's what so many of us are looking for in a time of such complexity and vulnerability. We just want someone to say, I see you, I hear you, I feel the same way, and we're in the same boat.
The point is, it can work, and we kind of think of this as an outlet for people who work within companies, but for companies themselves, this can be an incredibly useful tool, because so often, as companies, especially as they grow, particularly as they become structured and people start sort of lying up the reporting line and you're not getting real feedback from people working in the business, you can quite easily lose touch. It is, if you approach it with clarity and integrity, you can, I think, use it to really amplify and improve the operations of a business.
Yes, and the results are actually quite endless. I mean, you're looking at employee morale that then gets boosted. You're looking at productivity levels that then go up. And this is all linked to actual tangible data around teams that create that sense of psychological safety. Those people can even increase the turnover in their organizations and within their teams because they feel more motivated to do their best work. And think about what happens in the flow state when people are in a state of not consistent high cortisol levels in their bodies because they're not feeling stressed the whole time and scared the whole time, they can do their best work. So I really like what you're saying. And I think that the results are there. The use case is there and is definitely an opportunity for organizations to capitalize on this to get some of the great results that they want.
Zanele, thank you very much indeed. Zanele Njapa, the unlearning expert, the innovation facilitator, the concept of psychological safety at work. Very useful on both sides. But geez, it's got to be approached very, very carefully so that people don't sort of, again, that's an example of the colleague many, many years ago. Yeah, he said, I can go tell him, don't do it. You know that you are just sleep on it. Don't do it today. You're going to make a mistake. Where are you going? He told me to leave. In an environment where with fewer job protections than are around today, it was easy for the boss in those days to say, all right, you don't like it, well, off you go. And they did. Wendy Nola, you've been a real pain in the neck this week. Well done. Big questions for both Outsurance and Woolies. I'm not sure if we're going to get to both. Maybe we can hold one over for next week. But let's deal with the Outsurance question. And I think they got a bit agitated with you over some questions that you were asking them about their approach to customers.
Yeah, well, I thought they did. And when I went back to them for a little bit of clarification. I said, well, clearly this was a tiresome question because she started off saying, well, we've discussed this before. And she said, no, not tiresome at all. She's very gracious. But okay. So Neil Jacobs, an Outsurance client, was called on this Monday afternoon, by an Outsurance call center agent with quite an offer and not a new one. In summary, he said in an email to me, he wanted me to share my contacts list with him so that for every person who takes out insurance with them, Outsurance, my premium would reduce by 400 Rand. Is this practice allowed, he said. What is protecting my details in someone else's contact list who would provide Outsurance with this access? Well, I mean, he's already a client, but you the point is a good one. So I asked Outsurance, how is this POPIA compliant? I don't feel personally that I have the right to give my consent for somebody in my contacts list, let alone all of them, to be cold called by an insurer with a hard sell or anyone with a hard sell for that matter. I don't feel that that is my consent to give in the context of POPIA and certain provisions of the CPA as well. Speaking of the CPA, it has a section called referral selling, which says a person must not promote, offer, supply, agree to supply, or induce a consumer to accept any goods or services on the representation that the consumer will receive a rebate, commission, or other benefit if the customer subsequently does give up the names of customers, basically the scenario we're talking about here.
Right.
I also asked, so what are the terms and conditions of this deal? Is it a 400 Rand reduced premium indefinitely? And what if the person signs up and then cancels? Do you then reverse it? How does that work? I was intrigued. So I got a response from Outsurance's Chief Client Relations Officer, Natasha Kualesa. She says, as I said, we've discussed this in the past. We contact our clients to understand if there's anyone they believe would benefit from an Outsurance quote. Okay. There is a discount of 400 Rand applied to the next premium for a successful referral. So that's one premium. I said, so is there a limit to the number of times this can be supplied? What if 10 people in somebody's contact list decide to switch to Outsurance as a result? Is it 400 Rand, for 10 consecutive months, or how does it work? Well, obviously, they said if a client's premium is more than 400 Rand a month, then yes, it will be applied to 1 month. The premium for that month will be reduced by 400 Rand. If the premium is less than 400 Rand, the balance will be carried over to the following months. And if 10 clients move over, then that will be 4,000 Rand applied to the premium. This can be used all in 1 month, or difficult in some cases, or spread over months dependent on the customer's monthly premium value. Oh, okay. Now, this is the important bit. Prior to POPIA becoming effective, we obtained legal advice from a prominent law firm We've advised that our process is POPIA compliant and they do internal assessments. Generally, POPIA requires personal information to be obtained from the data subject directly, but the Act does, in Section 12, allow for the collection of personal information from a source other than the lead, provided that the collection from that other source does not prejudice the legitimate interest of the lead. Alternatively, the collection from that other source. What does it actually mean? I know. Exactly. Provided the source that provided the collection from
let's dial this back to the real world. I'm Bruce and I get a call and I phone our insurance because I would like some insurance. I phone them up and say hello and I sign up with them and they say, do you know anybody? He said, I know my friend Wendy. We was talking the other day about she's crossed with her insurance company. I'm sure she would like insurance. Why don't you phone Wendy? And I give them your phone number. That is a very different proposition because that's me sort of thinking of you, and you know, and yes, I'll get $400 off my next month's premium. The idea of handing over my entire contact list, however, is shambolically awful as a concept. I cannot believe that it's legal.
Abhorrent, actually. Exactly. So they're saying it's okay if the person whose names you've handed over, if they aren't prejudiced.
What does that mean?
But I still think, well, how does that actually tie in with privacy? Because if I don't fancy anyone handing my number out for somebody to call me because they're getting a discount, that doesn't sit very well with me at all. And apparently the CPA doesn't apply because the Financial Sector Regulation Act states that CPA doesn't apply to financial sector law, which I remember this back in the day when the CPA was still a bill, the consumer protection bill. The finance and services industry screamed blue murder and wanted to be carved out, and there was a lot of debate, and obviously they got their way. But apparently, says insurance, even if CPA did apply, this doesn't apply because this is an existing client who they're approaching for details. So it just sounded like a lot of semantics to me. And she ended by saying the vast majority of our customers and potential customers are happy and appreciate our processes that has resulted in material savings on insurance premiums, which helps keep them protected, ensures they are financially
But you and I
and a lot of other people, including who was it who wrote to me, Neil, feel really uncomfortable about this because, you know,
I think I would cancel my policy immediately if my insurer asked me to do that. I would tell them to go away.
Yeah, it doesn't sit well. No. And I think sometimes companies don't quite get how these things land with a lot of people. You can find a way to make it legal, but the POPIA Act and various other provisions should, I don't believe this is in the spirit of that. If I haven't given Neil permission, because I happen to be in his context, I happen to be on the same parents group as him or something at the school, and he didn't ask my permission, and suddenly I get a cold call from someone trying to sell me insurance, I'm not going to like Neil a whole lot.
I'm going to be unkind to the poor person who's been asked to phone me because they shouldn't be phoning me. The one that I haven't had for a while because I am on an opt-out list, it tends to work mostly very well, is the cold calling that happens automatically.
Robocalls.
And they don't identify themselves, the scoundrels. So, and there's no one to shout at, which I find most distressing because you can't be going, leave me alone.
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. I had one the other day and I'm a bit cross because as soon as I heard that vaulting robotic voice, I entered the call. But that has been outlawed by the Protection of Personal Information Act. So those shouldn't be happening anymore. And I should have actually listened to see which company it was and then raise hell.
Next time they do. I keep them on for as long as possible. I know it costs them nothing, but it's my passive aggressive fight back. It's my own little war. Wendy Donner. Save Woolies for next week. I wanted to get to the nuts and bolts of the insurance case. Thank you, Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja, asking difficult questions. And as she should. She should. That's her job. For companies, when Wendy phones, respond immediately. It just makes life so much more pleasant because she doesn't give up. She does not give up. She is like a consumer journalist with a bone. That's what she is. She doesn't let go, not for a moment. Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja on a Wednesday night.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Tonight's shapeshifter, as all shapeshifters do, has a reputation. Some of our shapeshifter reputations are more fun than others. I can happily take the mickey out of them, but Christelle Coleman's reputation is a deadly serious reputation. She is an entrepreneur who builds insurance businesses. How many have you built so far?
Hi, Bruce. Good evening. Is the line clear enough?
Clear enough, Christelle. Crystal clear. Absolutely.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, thank you. So, thanks for having me on your show. I'm very excited about our chat tonight. So this will now be my third startup. I have been in the industry for more than 30 years. So, you know, it is over a span of three decades. But yes, I've been in the business of starting up specialist insurance businesses, and I've been privileged to work with some of the biggest corporates in the market who have supported my dreams. And we've built amazing businesses and we've created jobs. I was listening to your interview with a Standard Bank representative a little bit earlier this evening, and I was just reflecting on you know, how many jobs we've created over the years. So at this stage of my life, starting up a new insurance business with a new value proposition and a new approach, and hopefully creating many more jobs for our economy.
And why could you give it an easier name to pronounce? Is it Amy, AMI? What is it?
Okay, so the name is definitely an interesting talking point. So when we wanted to create a business that is based on the, you know, the premise of trust and friendship. So insurance as a whole is a grudge purchase in South Africa. It is not trusted by, many of the policyholders don't trust the insurance companies that they do business with. And the name is actually pronounced Ami, like similar to the French name Mon Ami, my friend. Oh, right. But the word actually has the same meaning in about 12 different languages around the world. So it's all got to do with, you know, similar spelling, but it's friend, it's mother, it's much loved, it's trusted. And we felt it really spoke to the foundation on which we wanted to build this business. So Ami is an underwriting manager for Lombard Insurance Company. So we're not, all on our own and trying to do something, with no one behind us. We've got very strong investors and backers. And yes, and we focus on the personal lines segment of the industry. So your cars, your homes, your mostly focused on the top end of the market. So your wealth and aspirational segments and art collections, whiskey collections, travel insurance, all those sort of more sort of aspirational classes of insurance, but that has got to do with you as an individual or a family.
Now, take me back 30 years. You say you've been in the insurance industry 30 years. Did you start out in corporate? Did you start out like everybody else does, sort of in a job? And where was that? How did that play out?
So I come from quite an interesting background. My parents were, I didn't come from a privileged upbringing, if I can put it like that. We don't have enough time for me to tell you that whole story.
Christelle. You could tell us the story. Yes. I do want to hear the story, because I do like stories of people who are not born to privilege, who are maybe motivated by the fact that they weren't born to privilege, and that drives them and gives them an energy. Do please feel free to tell the story. Sorry to interrupt as you were in full flight, but I think we'd like to hear it.
Okay, Bruce, I've got a problem with the sound. I just want to see if I can hear you better.
Okay, I'll tell you what, Christelle, we're going to pause for a moment because clearly let's rather get Christelle on a phone line. I mean, these digital lines are absolutely great when they work, but when they don't, they're awful. So let's let Christelle do that. We'll come back to Christelle and that life story. We want the life story. You want the life story? Of course you want the life story. We'll do the life story in a moment.
Shapeshifters.
So we were about to launch into the detail and the glorious detail of the life and times of Christelle Coleman, the chief executive and founder of Ami, now I know, underwriting managers, part of Lombard Insurance. And then the communication went awry, hoping that we are better connected now to communicate more clearly, Christelle Coleman. Christelle, people. And we do want to hear the life story. You can do the Reader's Digest version of it, because we like stories of people who are motivated by their backgrounds to do better and to improve the lot of humanity. And clearly you're motivated to create jobs and create opportunities. So do tell, even if it's the Reader's Digest version.
Okay, Bruce, thank you. So thanks for having me back. So my I grew up on a wine farm, but my parents lost everything. And we ended up in the early 80s in Philippines. Now, not to be very, disrespectful for, towards anyone who lives in Crossroads or Philippi, but in 1981, we were the only people, white people, who lived there, to give you an idea of how desperate our situation was. And my parents were both alcoholics, so I had a really, really bad start to life. And when I finished school, I just, I've always been very industrious. I've always found ways to make money, selling hot dogs in boarding school to pay for my school fees and, just really find a way to earn an income. I went looking for a job. I walked, through the city of Cape Town, walked into Santam's office and asked if they have a place where I can apply for a job. And I got a job at Santam straight out of school in 1990. And my career in insurance started there. And I always say that the insurance industry is an industry for entrepreneurs and for industrious people. If you are prepared to work hard, study while you work, you can get some amazing opportunities. And my first opportunity came at the age of 24 when I went for a job interview at Hanover Reinsurance. You would know the reinsurance company, one of the big insurers in the world. And the CEO at the time, Steve Murphy, used to interview every single person who came to work for the company. And I had an interview with Steve for quite a junior job. And I told him about, what I did in my previous job. And he said, "Why don't you come and start a company for us?" And I was like, I didn't even know what an underwriting agency was. And I got offered an opportunity to start a company called Thatch Risk Acceptances, which is a specialist thatch underwriter, at the age of 25. And the company is still going 27 years later.
Thatch Risk Acceptances. I mean, what an astonishing story. And I'm sure you're skipping out a lot of the detail of the sweat and bloodshed in between, Christelle, because you walk in without a tertiary qualification. Do you study? Do you get tertiary qualifications in the meantime, or are you just too busy for that?
No, I mean, in the insurance industry, it's a heavily regulated industry, and we have to, have our qualifications from, our legal exams to doing our insurance qualifications. I did, Bruce, I am a little bit of an adventurous one, so I did attempt to start my MBA 2 years ago, just before I turned 50. I got accepted because of my career and my history at Stellenbosch Business School. And it's actually the reason why I decided to try my third startup, because I was sitting in class, the oldest in class, obviously, and, thinking, am I going to spend 2 years learning, about stuff that I know, and with no disrespect to anyone with an MBA, or am I going to use 2 years to build a business? And I decided to start the long road towards a financial services startup. It's not that easy nowadays anymore as it was in the 90s. And it takes a long time. But yes, that's why I'm here today.
So hold on. I just need to be absolutely clear. So you don't have a tertiary qualification. You have required insurance qualifications, but you don't have a degree. Because people put a lot of emphasis on degrees, and you must study and you must have a degree. And I don't know what your view is on that now, but certainly for you, it hasn't been pivotal.
No, well, I do believe that, a strong academic sort of background and qualification puts you ahead in life. You have to work much harder if you don't have that. And my kids definitely are studying for as long as they possibly can and willing to. But I never did my degree, no. And it was one of the reasons why I wanted to do my MBA, because I was so desperate to get that qualification behind my name. I've got my associateship, which is a qualification in the insurance industry, but no degree, no.
But it's funny, the psychology of the degree is something important, but you've dropped out of the MBA, have you? And instead you've gone on hold. No, I mean, again, can somebody not give you an honorary MBA? I think a third business startup entitles you to at least an honorary MBA or something. What was number two? So Thatch Risk was in at the
in
age
the
of 24, 24, 25 within Hanover Re. What was number two?
So I approached, you know, I ran another specialist UMA for about 10 years called MUA, also part of Hannover Re. And then I had this dream of doing a startup for Old Mutual Insure because I didn't have a wealth offering. So I approached OMI, and I, like Shark Tank, pitched the idea to do a high net worth startup. So I started up a company 5 years ago called Elite Risk Acceptances.
Yes.
Which is quite a success. It's a huge success story. But I, you know, I like having shareholding in the businesses that I start. I think it's very important because that's, that was the business model that Hannover Re was very successful in. From the early days when they started with investing in startups in the 80s. So the elite business, I didn't have any shareholding, and I thought I could work for a boss and for a corporate, but it wasn't for me. Even though I left after we started 4 years, the company was, doing exceptionally well. We grew right through COVID, wrote hundreds of millions in premium income, and it's a fantastic business. So very proud of that business and achievement there. But it was my own shop, and that's something that's really important to me.
Okay, so again, you helped start it, and so now on startup number 3, AMI, or underwriting managers, it's under the Lombard stable, but you are now, I'm sure, more inclined to call the shots.
Well, I'm not the only shareholder. So the business is, Lombard also has a shareholding in the AMI business, as well as Carl Nolte. He's one of the founders of Easy Equities. Yes, he's my partner.
Okay.
So Carl and I are the two individual shareholders, and then we have Lombard as a partner, and then we trade as you can say it like that, or we underwrite for Lombard Insurance Company license, which is a fantastic business. It's a, it's a privately owned insurance company started in the 1990s in South Africa, but has got a huge global spread. And it's a success story in itself, but the way they do things really resonated with what we wanted to achieve in our business. So we're super excited about this.
I mean, it's wonderful that you're in this process. I mean, do you see this one as the final startup, or do you have a particular, desire to start these things up? You've got the sort of, you're a sucker for punishment, because the first two or three years of any business is so flippin' difficult. But if you've got the skill and the ability to do it, I wonder whether that becomes addictive or not.
I really don't think I'll do this again. I mean, this last time has been particularly challenging because it has become very difficult to do startups in the financial services sector of this nature. You know, I'm not saying it's as hard to start a brokerage, for instance, but the regulatory hoops are endless that you have to jump through. It takes a very long time. And I've been joking so often recently to say that people who start up underwriting managers in South Africa at this point in time are the ones who can just hold on long enough to see the business actually go to market, because it took us 18 months to get to a point of selling the first policy. It is just incredibly difficult. And the market is a lot more risk averse since COVID happened. The due diligence exercise that we went through was extremely intense. And I don't know if I'll be able to to do this again. This is my dream. You know, every time I started a business, it was one step closer to where I wanted to be. And I learned through the process. I mean, you were talking about me not having a degree, but I definitely have, you learn certain things through starting businesses that you will never learn sitting in a classroom.
No, completely.
Of business.
No, but that's why MBA students are sort of, they building careers. They may be in their late 20s. They've had management responsibility. They've got line reports. There are people who are wanting to embark on the next phase, and an MBA accelerates that process. And it works incredibly well for sort of mid-level sort of managers and stuff to really get them to understand the language of business and understand the way in which the world connects and do it in a fairly quick period of time. And so, at 50, it was massively ambitious, but I'm glad you realized that you know all of the stuff already, Christelle.
Absolutely.
No, and again, on startup number three, do we box above our weight worldwide in terms of insurance companies? As you say, Lombard, and I was unaware of Lombard's global reach, and I'm going to go do some research on Lombard, because we know auto in general has done so incredibly well with multiple brands in Asia and Australia and in the United Kingdom, where they've got the second biggest aggregator in the UK, Outsurances, to rethink its model quite a lot in Australia, but it's doing nicely. Suntum has done well all over the African continent and is trying different things all over the place. It does seem as if South Africa, broadly, is pretty good at this insurance game.
We are, and I'm so proud of our industry. For a couple of years, I was a CEO of Europe Assistance Africa, which is a French-owned global organization, 35 countries around the world. I'll tell you, I was the only female CEO in the group, so that was quite an interesting experience with the French.
Sure.
Generali owns Europe Assistance, so I got to see a lot of what's happening in insurance worldwide. South Africa is extremely innovative and entrepreneurial in the way that we do insurance. Another good example of a company that's gone global that's done really, really well is Hollard. Lombard actually shares some of its DNA with Hollard, because one of the founders of Hollard is also the founder owner of Lombard, Miles Jaffers. Interesting sort of plot point there. But Lombard's global turnover is in the region of 18 billion rand, of which about 3 billion is in South Africa. And most of their business is in the UK, where they do specialist lines like pet insurance, travel insurance, liability lines, and that sort of thing. This is a South African business that's punching, very, very strongly in the UK market. So we have a lot to be proud of, and I think it's because of our innovative approach. And we South Africans, we hate insurance. I also have an insurance policy. But we live in a country with a diverse set of risks. We have to be very innovative in how we manage and price these risks and the products that we develop. And, we're up for the challenge. And I think that's quite attractive to some of the more conservative markets. For instance, by way of example, in the UK, you take out a motor policy with one insurer and a home policy with another insurer. But, this policy set up that we have in South Africa, where everything's under one policy, that was something that was invented here by Suntum in the year, in the 70s with a multiplex policy. That was brand new innovation, and now it's something that everyone does. So I think that's why we are seen as forerunners as far as innovation is concerned.
Christelle, what a pleasure to talk to you this evening. I'm glad we got you on a clear line, and thank you for giving us a little taste of an astonishing career. Chief Executive and Founder of AMI Underwriting Managers. Now I know how to pronounce it. Christelle Coleman this evening. What a lovely story. What a lovely career story as well. And born out of hardship, and so many South Africans' lives are born out of hardship, and it makes people incredibly resilient and incredibly resourceful and incredibly determined to not have to go back to a place which they found to be uncomfortable or unhappy. And she has built three phenomenal businesses in her time. Thatch Risk Acceptances, 1998. And then, of course, the other one was Elite Risk Acceptances under the old Mutual banner. There, she couldn't work for a boss. Signed up for the MBA. Put it on hold. I think she's dropped out. I think she's left. I don't think she's going back there. I don't think she's going back to the classroom. Can somebody just please give her an honorary MBA or an honorary degree of some description? Because she's got the scars of a lifetime in insurance to show her prowess and her ability. And again, with the correct approach, the lucky breaks, the determination to excel, the importance of degrees gets called into question all over again. Christelle Coleman, I think it's much harder today to succeed without a degree than perhaps it was 30 years ago. But my goodness gracious me, what a story of tenacity, determination, and ultimately success.